From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast of the best of Weekends and All Things Considered. The highlights from our shows this weekend. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program Saturday and Sunday. This episode, the gap between rich and poor in America is wider than at any other time in more than 80 years. So does it matter? Well, it could mean the difference between a slow recovery and a quick one.
The typical male worker today makes less than the typical worker made in 1969.
Also, bringing some Amsterdam vibe to Denver, where marijuana shops now outnumber Starbucks.
Some shops are going to be geared more towards the cannabis enthusiast with connoisseur-grade strains, a little bit higher prices.
Plus, the man who built his dream car, a giant banana on four wheels, and has planned to drive it around the world. And later, the con man who scammed his way to the top of American society and how he pulled it off for 30 years.
This case is like a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
And a one-time opera singer burning up the R&B and soul charts with her new record. She goes by Lettucey. That's all in this episode of the Best of Weekends on All Things Considered. A couple weeks ago, Sarah Bloom Raskin, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, gave a speech here in Washington, and the topic was the growing gap between rich and poor in America. And in that speech, she said something striking.
This inequality is destabilizing and undermines the ability of the economy to grow sustainably and efficiently. It is associated with increases...
We'll hear more from Raskin in a moment. Now, when Federal Reserve governors speak, they speak cautiously. Their words can move markets. But what Sarah Bloom Raskin was essentially saying was this. The economic recovery might be slow going for a long, long time if the income gap continues to grow. And how big is it? Well, the latest statistics show that right now, the wealthiest 1% of Americans earn more than 20% of all the money generated in this country each year. And the last time the gap was so wide? 1928. Right before the stock market crashed, leading to the Great Depression. That's our cover story today, the growing income gap, why it might be making the economy worse. In a recent issue of The Washington Post, reporter Peter Wariski wrote about a man named Kenneth Douglas, who was a corporate executive back in the mid-1970s.
He is the CEO of Dean Foods, which is a dairy company that has become one of the largest dairy companies in the U.S.
Kenneth Douglas was, by all accounts, a talented CEO.
The company is doing great. Profits are going up very quickly. Revenues are going up very quickly. All of these good things are happening to the company. And the board, his board of directors said, Ken, we want to give you some more money. And he would say repeatedly, no, he was making enough.
Douglas thought it would be bad for morale. Besides, he was happy with his pay. His compensation package in today's dollars was $1 million a year. Douglas had a nice three-bedroom home in the Chicago suburbs. He had access to a company car, membership in a country club. But that was the 1970s. Today, things at Dean Foods are a lot different, especially for the current CEO, a man named Greg Engels.
So he has averaged about $10 million a year, 10 times as much as Ken Douglas. And he lives a much different life.
How so?
Well, he's got a $6 million house in Dallas. He's got property in Vail. He's got membership in four different golf clubs. He's got a corporate jet. Ken Douglas, back in the 70s, had a Cadillac. But it's just a whole new level of executive grandeur that we see today.
Greg Engels is hardly an extreme case. Last year, top CEOs saw their pay rise by 23%, according to a recent New York Times study. The average worker, a pay increase of just 0.5%. And corporate executives now account for most of the very richest Americans. Peter Wariski found that executive pay has gone up 400% since the 1970s. And at Dean Foods, after you adjust for inflation, the average employee actually makes 9% less than they would have in the 1970s.
They honestly said they were just happy to have jobs.
Wariski actually traveled to a Dean Foods milk plant to speak with some of those workers.
They said they thought about how much the new CEO, Mr. Engels, makes. They were resentful of it, but for the most part, they were just trying to figure out how to get by, and a lot of them have second jobs.
According to the Federal Reserve, over the past 2 years, middle-income earners, these are families earning around $50,000 a year, saw their net worth drop by 20%. The numbers are even worse for the poorest fifth of Americans. But for the top 1%, it's almost the reverse. They're earning more, a lot more. And economists have different theories as to the economic consequences of this gap. Here's one of them. America's economy has long depended on middle-class consumer spending. It's the engine of our economy. So if 90% of Americans are either seeing their wages stagnate or worse, what happens when the engine starts to sputter, when people can't spend money? That's a question I put to Sarah Bloom Raskin, the Federal Reserve governor we heard from earlier.
Combined with widespread unemployment, you know, housing and stock market declines, increasing rates of mortgage defaults, foreclosures and bankruptcies, the assets of many American families have been significantly eroded. One consequence of this is we want to understand better how inequality is growing through both a fall in the bottom as well as a rise in the top.
If this gap continues to grow, could you conceive a future where there is a relatively small middle class in America, a middle class that is not necessarily able to sort of drive the engine of the U.S. economy, which traditionally, of course, has been consumption?
I think that that's something that needs to be looked at carefully. I mean, clearly, there have been studies showing that growing levels of income inequality are associated with increases in crime, profound strains on households, lower savings rates, poorer health outcomes, diminished levels of trust in people and institutions. And those are all trends that I think are forces that have the potential to drag down maximum economic growth.
That's Sarah Bloom Raskin. She serves on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and she spoke to me from her office here in Washington. Governor Raskin, thank you.
Thank you.
A Harvard economist named David Moss studies income inequality. And 3 years ago, he had a breakthrough.
Well, there was a chart that I had created back in late 2008, looking at bank failures from the 19th century up to the present. And an interesting pattern emerged, which was they peak up in crisis years, which occurred fairly often. Then they peak up, especially in the 1920s. But then most striking, after 1933, when we saw the introduction of federal financial regulation and banking regulation, these banking crises disappear almost completely, so close to zero you can almost not tell the difference. And then it continues very, very low until the early 1980s. Then they pick back up again. Anyway, so I made that chart.
So he had his chart of bank failures. And, of course, the 1980s marks a point of a return to deregulation. A few months after making this chart, one of David Moss's colleagues mentioned a similar chart, except one that looked at income inequality. And he asked Moss,
have you ever thought about how that curve looks almost exactly like this chart on bank failures? And so we took that curve and we plotted it on the same page with bank failures. And lo and behold, it was a striking connection. So as bank failures started to go up in the 1920s, inequality was going up in the 1920s. And as inequality came down in the 1930s, bank failures came down and stayed down. They both stayed down together through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Just about the time we see financial deregulation, up they both go. Inequality goes up and bank failures go up together. Who knows exactly what's causing what there, if anything, but there was certainly quite a remarkable coincidence.
So there is, in your view, a correlation between income inequality and financial failure, economic failure.
I think there's probably some connection, although, again, I wish we knew for sure. But there are a lot of hypotheses, and some of them may well turn out to be true. There are a lot of people looking at, is there a connection between especially extreme inequality and economic growth? Does it cut down on demand? Do we see spending not as vibrant, especially coming out of a recession when inequality is high? Do we see more borrowing? Do we see more risk-taking? Some people suggest, I think there might be something to this, that as you get higher inequality, up at the top, there's more and more resources in order to lobby Congress and so on, and you get more deregulation of key sectors, including the financial sector. The more you do that, the more the inequality rises and on and on. And so those are, I think, some of the things that we should be looking at and trying to understand.
How would you suggest narrowing that gap? I mean, is it just a matter of getting the economy back up and running as it once was?
Well, getting the economy up and running is a big part of it. As many people say, we need to think about education. How do we make sure that we're doing a good job of education all across the spectrum? But then there are some things that aren't talked about too much. My guess is if you say, why did inequality come down so much after the 30s? a very large role was the war. The war brought people together across every income, ethnic, other class. I think that probably led many executives, for example, at leading corporations, just to not even think about asking for the kind of salaries that are now typical. I think that gradually that sense of cohesion has begun to atrophy, has begun to break, and now people feel much more comfortable asking for the kind of salaries that they're getting at the very, very top end.
Harvard economist David Moss. Writer and historian Jeff Madrick recently wrote a book about how we got here and where we might be headed. It's called The Age of Greed.
In the 1970s, there was an assault on government oversight and regulation. It was followed through time and again over the ensuing years. And eventually, the financial community stopped playing by the rules. There was an economic theory that kept justifying what they were doing. And the American public were not fully aware of what was going on.
Why is the income inequality gap a problem, in your view? I mean, what does it matter if there's a gap? I mean, does it affect everybody?
Well, you know, we should think of it not only as a gap. In fact, we should think of it more as stagnation of wages. And stagnation of wages really bothers me. The typical male worker today, in the middle of the pack, the median, makes less today, less, discounted for inflation, than the typical median worker made in 1969. The idea that people make the same or less today than they made 40 years ago is a stunning historical fact.
Has the idea of greed, has it become a patriotic idea in the minds of most Americans?
I think it's become acceptable. It's become even something to be proud of. I doubt it's a patriotic or American thing, but I suppose you're getting to an interesting point. Do we think it's part of our heritage? It would be dead wrong to think so. Self-interest is central to a free enterprise system. But greed implies something else. Greed implies making so much money you're willing to violate the rules. And that begins to undermine the economy, undermine prosperity, and most important, undermine the potential for economic growth.
Economic historian Jeff Madrick, author of The Age of Greed. He also notes that the gap between rich and poor in America is now wider than Cameroon, Nigeria, India, and even Egypt. The city of Denver now has more medical marijuana dispensaries than it does Starbucks. Over 300 locations to buy pot. That's a lot of options for medical marijuana patients. So Denver's alternative weekly newspaper, Westward, has set out to help readers sift through some of those options. And they've hired a professional marijuana critic. He goes by the pen name William Breeze. And he joins us now from the studios of KUVO in Denver. William Breeze, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First of all, I should say that is not your real name, right? This is the name that you use in your column because you hide your identity on purpose.
Yeah. You know, when we go into medical marijuana dispensaries in Colorado, we have to show an ID as well as our state-issued medical marijuana card. And on that has my real name. In order to disassociate myself from these reviews, I had to adopt a pen name. And it's worked out pretty well.
So you wouldn't want them to know who you were because then they would give you special treatment in exchange for a good review.
Yeah, that or you're not always writing good reviews. So it's also nice to have that sort of shield from that sometimes.
Here's the thing. What's going on in Denver? How is it that Denver has more medical marijuana dispensaries than Starbucks?
Well, I think the way a lot of people tell it is in 2009, there was a memo sent by the Attorney General of the United States essentially saying that they weren't going to prosecute people who were in line with their state's medical marijuana policies. And in Colorado, we have a constitutional amendment to be able to have medical cannabis. And so a lot of people took that as a go-ahead to start up storefronts and businesses. And it just blew up from there. We have more than 100,000 licensed medical marijuana cardholders in the state. You know, a lot of these places saw that there was money to be made there and patients to be helped.
Now, not everybody can just walk in and buy pot, right?
No, you need a doctor's recommendation first to get a medical marijuana card. That takes about 35 days to get it. Once you get your card, you can go and shop at any of the dispensaries around town.
Are there price wars? I mean, are the dispensaries trying to sort of undercut, you know, other ones?
Yeah. Oh, right now in Denver, there's huge price wars. Ounces are down from $350, $325 an ounce back in 2007, 2008 on the black market to medical marijuana, $170 for an ounce, I think I saw an ad we ran today in Westward.
And how long would that last?
Well, I mean, I tend to go through at least a half gram to a gram a day medically. I mean, that's on the very low end, and there's 28 grams in an ounce, so... In Colorado, we're allowed 2 ounces a month.
That's a lot of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. A better lot. Way to yeah. think of it maybe would be a joint is anywhere between a half gram to a gram.
So how does it work? What do you look for when you are actually reviewing marijuana?
Well, when I'm reviewing marijuana, I'm looking for how clean it's grown, how well it's grown. Another big part of it is that I'm not just reviewing the cannabis. I'm also reviewing the centers themselves. I look at it from not just my point of view, but how would an older patient feel going into this place? How would someone new to cannabis feel in this place? Some shops are going to be geared more towards the cannabis enthusiast with connoisseur-grade strains, a little bit higher prices. Other shops are catering more towards the mass market. As long as your staff is friendly and they know what they're talking about and your shop is clean and makes me feel all right going in there. I said recently, if it makes me feel icky going in a place, then it would probably make my grandma feel icky going in a place. And there's plenty of grandmas around the Denver community with medical marijuana cards going to these dispensaries.
So now, given that there are more dispensaries in Denver than Starbucks, do you think that they should just start selling coffee?
That's a good one. A lot of them do actually serve up lattes and things like that for their patients.
Starbucks should be worried.
Who knows? That may be in their business model down the line.
That's William Breeze. That's a pen name for the medical marijuana critic for Westward. That's a weekly alternative newspaper in Denver. He spoke to me from the studios of KUVO in Denver. William, thanks, man.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That book, Cars and Trucks and Things That Go by Richard Scarry? Well, Steve Braithwaite from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, has built an actual working banana mobile without Bananas Gorilla, of course, and he's planning to drive it around the world next spring, in part for fun and in part for charity. The idea for the big banana car came to Braithwaite a few years ago when he was in a gas station paying for a fill-up, and near the cash register he noticed a bowl of bananas.
And I'd never really noticed before, but a lot of the bananas, instead of being that curvy boomerang shape that you think of, they actually curved at the back, but then they ran fairly straight. So I pick one of these up, and I'm holding it and examining it from every angle, thinking, I could build a car this shape. The wheels would go there, the passengers, the engine. Not realizing, the line ahead of me had completely cleared, and I'm now standing in the middle of the store with 10 people behind me, and the lady had to prod me in the shoulder and tell me, buddy, it's your turn.
All right, so how did you do it? How did you actually create a banana mobile? What did you do?
I ended up buying a 1993 Ford F-150 and using that as the donor vehicle.
You just took the entire body out of the car, and you were just left with the chassis.
Yes, so all the important parts were still there. I just needed then to fabricate an enormous banana on top of that chassis. Why do you keep laughing? Everybody keeps laughing at me. I thought this was perfectly normal.
So how did you get the? So now, how did you get the banana around the Ford F-150?
I took the banana that I chose as my model, sliced it, drew around all the slices, put those into my computer, and enlarged them onto sheets of plywood, cut those out with a jigsaw, and then fitted those wooden forms to the Ford frame. Then covered it with chicken wire. Sprayed the chicken wire with urethane foam, and then fiberglassed on top of that.
Yes. I've seen it. You can see it online at our website. It actually looks like a banana. It's not like a cartoon banana. It's like a real huge banana that could feed an entire city on wheels.
Exactly. If they saw it off in the distance, I wanted them to think it was actually a banana that was just 5 feet away.
Now, you have a plan to take the car around the world. What's the point of the trip?
There is no point, absolutely no point whatsoever. If there is a point, it's just to have a blast.
What are some of the countries that you're gonna go through? What's your route?
I kind of have an idea inside my head, but this is what's going to happen. When we meet people and we tell them, oh, tomorrow we're going to be going to such and such a place. They're going to say, oh, no, 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 go to somewhere, some other place. My brother lives there. He'll look after you. He'll put you up. And so it's going to be a very zigzaggy route, I have no doubt. I want to take a more northerly route that would take us through the Czech Republic, Slovakia, the Ukraine, Russia, and maybe Mongolia into China. My brother, he has these romantic notions of following the old Silk Trail, which would be a more southerly route. So we would drop down to the Mediterranean, go through Turkey, and then cross the Caspian Sea and take some of the Stan countries to China that way. I kind of like that idea. It takes us near Spain, and I love paella, so I'd like to stop one night and have paella for dinner, but I have no clue, really, what route we're going to take.
That's Steve Braithwaite. He plans to drive around the world with his brother Spade. You can get updates on their journey on Twitter at Big Banana Car. Steve Braithwaite, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you very much indeed.
We hope to see you in Washington when you come through here.
Washington sounds brilliant.
But she says, bananas, just give me bananas, those lovely bananas, that's the food for me.
Oh, yes.
I love bananas, big ripe bananas, delicious bananas.
Our book today is a story so riveting it's hard to believe it's nonfiction. For 30 years, a man who was born in Germany as Christian Gerhardsreiter claimed to be someone else in cities across America. He posed as a British aristocrat, a Las Vegas cardiologist, a Hollywood producer, a New York bond broker, and finally, as a member of the Rockefeller family. His ruse came to an end in 2008 when the man then known as Clark Rockefeller was charged with kidnapping his daughter. He was convicted, and this past week he pleaded not guilty to another crime, committing murder in Los Angeles 2 decades ago. Mark Seal, a writer for Vanity Fair, writes about Gerhardsreiter in his new book, The Man in the Rockefeller Suit. And the story begins in the late 1970s when the 17-year-old Gerhardsreiter decided to leave his small town in Bavaria and head to the U.S., specifically to another small town in Connecticut.
And it was here that he began his journey. He was obsessed with American television, especially, I hope you'll remember, Gilligan's Island.
Yes.
And the eccentric East Coast millionaire Thurston Howell III.
A millionaire.
I'll appeal. I'll take it to the Supreme Court. I'll go even higher. Rules Committee of the Newport Country Club.
He wanted to be like Thurston Howell III.
That's right. Even in Germany, as a student in Germany, he would call the motor vehicle department and act like he was a millionaire wanting to register a Rolls Royce, when in actuality he was a middle-class kid in the middle of this tiny village in Bavaria. So he always wanted to be someone else, according to the records and the people that I interviewed. And pretty soon he had left this family in Connecticut, and he was on his way to college in Wisconsin, and he told his roommate there, he was from Boston, that his father was an industrialist, and to prove that he was from Boston, he would eat a Boston cream pie every day.
He soon takes on the name of Christopher Mountbatten Chichester, and eventually ends up in San Marino in Southern
yes.
California, a very wealthy suburb of Los Angeles, and ingratiates himself into the kind of the high society there. How does he do it, and who is funding him?
Well, the police say that he had various little scams going on along the way. He had money from his parents, but he had no occupation or no real job at this point. But he was welcomed in San Marino. Now, you have to picture this place. It's only 12 miles out of Los Angeles.
And by the way, we're talking about the mid-'80s, 1980s here.
That's right. So when this young man came, they welcomed him. And when his claims became grandiose, they thought, well, he's eccentric. He's a Mountbatten. He's a Chichester. He claimed to be related to Sir Francis Chichester, who sailed around the world.
He eventually moved in with somebody in San Marino. Her name was Ruth Didi Sohus. How did he get connected with her?
He was connected through the church. That's what he would always do. And in San Marino, it was a church called the Church of Our Savior. And he became an usher, and he would always be at the social hour. And he met some people there who told him about this apartment in a woman named Didi Sohus's house. And that's when the almost Alfred Hitchcock part of the book began.
Which involves, of course, murder.
Possibly. It involved a missing persons case. What happened was is that Didi had a son, a young son named John Sohus, who was a low-level computer operator. And Christian Chichester was living rent-free in the garage apartment when John and his fiancée, Linda moved into the main house with John's mother. And then suddenly this couple disappears under extremely mysterious circumstances. And years later, the house was sold, and the new owners were putting in a swimming pool, and the crew dug up the bones of what is believed to have been John Soas.
Wow. After that incident, he leaves. He moves to Greenwich in Connecticut, and he takes on a whole new persona.
That's right. And the police were wanting to question him. He was a person of interest in this missing persons case after the bones were discovered. But they couldn't find him because he was under a new name, Christopher Crowe. By now, he says he's a producer and director of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which was indeed a television series at the time, with a director named Christopher Crowe, only not him. He begins working at esteemed financial institutions on the East Coast.
I'm speaking with the author Mark Seal about his new book. It's called The Man in the Rockefeller Suit. It's the story of Clark Rockefeller, a man who conned high society from California to Connecticut for more than 30 years. He had a lot of weird habits, right? I mean, he would write about how he would initials embroidered on his clothing. At one point, he would eat very peculiar and specific foods as well?
Yes. When he became Clark Rockefeller, he became eccentric in a way that people chalked up to being a Rockefeller. Just a few of the eccentricities. He never carried money. He was paranoid about security and privacy to the point where he would carry a radio device that he said was connected to the Rockefeller offices. He would never eat in restaurants because he said you can't trust the kitchen. He would only eat in private clubs, of which he was indeed a member of several. He only ate white foods, white turkey on white Pepperidge Farm bread, and except in some cases when he would order oysters Rockefeller, and he would be at a private club and he would tell his companion, "Do you know why they call them oysters Rockefeller?" And they would say, "No." He goes, "Because they're green, you know, the color of money." He told people that he was worth exactly $400 million. I mean, lie after lie after lie after lie. And his crowning achievement, Clark Rockefeller of New York.
Christian Gerhardsreiter, this kid from Germany, becomes a part of the American aristocracy. He meets a woman in New York, and they end up getting married.
Yeah, she was a Harvard MBA, or studying to get her MBA, a bright, intelligent, attractive career woman who felt that he was the smartest man she had ever met.
Her name is Sandra Boss, and they get married, they have a child, they eventually end up in Beacon Hill, in a $2.5 million house on Beacon Hill in Boston, not too far from the home of Senator John Kerry and other wealthy Bostonites. Even there, people just assume that this is a Rockefeller.
Yes, and by then he had what he claimed to be $1 billion worth of modern art on his walls, which of course turned out, like everything else, to be a fake. Then his facade began to fall apart.
How did that happen?
What happened was is that he fell in love with this little girl, Snooks, he called her,
his daughter,
that he and Sandra had together. And as a police investigator told me in the book, everything in this man's life was a lie. The only real thing in his life was his love of his daughter. And when he lost his daughter in a bitter divorce, he began plotting on how to get her back, creating this incredibly intricate plan to kidnap his daughter off a Boston street and take her to Baltimore, where he had set up yet another identity as Chip Smith, a high seas ship captain. He had bought a house on an appropriately named street, Ploy Street, and he kidnapped the daughter, and he had a succession of people waiting to ferry him from one place to another, and then he disappeared off the map. And for about 4 or 5, 6 days, nobody knew where he was. But they put out a wanted poster, and people called in and said, "Hey, I knew him as Christopher Chichester in San Marino, California."
Wow.
People in Greenwich say, "I knew him as Christopher Crowe." People in Baltimore, "I knew him as Chip Smith." And it blew the lid off a 30-year con, this kidnapping.
He was caught. He was put on trial. He was convicted of kidnapping his daughter. But at least publicly, he never denied being Clark Rockefeller, right? He still insisted that that's who he was.
That's right. In the kidnapping trial, he went under the name of Clark Rockefeller. He did not testify. He pled insanity. But so many other people in his life did testify. His first wife, who he had married for the green card, his second wife, people that he knew on Beacon Hill. So the court was, it was really interesting. But, you know, I sat in that courtroom and I thought I knew the story, but it was really only the beginning. I knew that I had to go back to his beginnings in Germany and trace him step by step along the way to really try to understand this man who did not exist.
Wow. That's Mark Seal. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book, The Man in the Rockefeller Suit. It's about Clark Rockefeller. Mark Seal, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
The voice you're about to hear belongs to an R&B singer named Ledisi. She's our music feature today.
One call, two calls, three calls. Is that what I do to you? Outside my door, scared to be alone. I know you're addicted to.
This track is called Hate Me, and it's off Ledisi's new record, Pieces of Me. Now, not too long ago, before she became known as an R&B singer, you'd have probably heard Ledisi singing parts written by Puccini or Wagner. She spent years honing her operatic voice, first as a child prodigy and later at UC Berkeley. But those days are long gone. Ledisi is becoming a star in the world of R&B, and her new record, her fifth studio album, is quite possibly her most personal. Ledisi joins me from our studios at NPR West. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So the song that we're hearing, it's called Hate Me, which I imagine has a story behind it. I wonder if, or whether you can tell me what this whole record, Pieces of Me, is actually about.
Well, Pieces of Me is celebrating being a full woman. I'm becoming a great woman that I adore. It takes a while to really love yourself, and so I'm celebrating all those different parts. And I can be very sensual, spiritual, aggressive, which is like the song Hate Me, and very just exuberant. And I wanted to express those sides.
You have been in this business, in the recording business, the entertainment business, for a long time. You really started at the age of 8. You've had several Grammy nominations, and yet I read that you had doubts even about this record, you know, as to whether you could ever even make it.
I'm always doubting because I've been told so much that you're not the right look or you're not the right sound, and you know, whether I do jazz or R&B, there are always complaints, and I would just listen to the complaints about what I do instead of celebrating what I do and that I'm different and I'm in my own lane, and to embrace that.
Tell me about your family, because you grew up in a pretty musical family. Your mom was in an R&B band in Louisiana. You were performing at the age of 8 with a New Orleans Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, my mom saw that I had a talent, so she would put me in programs, and one of the programs was NOCA, and only 4 students per school was able to perform with the New Orleans Symphony. So I was one of the students chosen for that after-school program. That was my first introduction to opera.
And opera, of course, became a really big part of your life. You went on to study at UC Berkeley in the Young Musicians Program. I'm assuming, by the way, that you're a mezzo-soprano, is that?
Yes, I am. How did you know?
Lucky guess. I was listening to this record through the prism of knowing that you studied opera, and it was weird. It just made sense to me. I thought, there's this strange kind of symbiosis between R&B, soul, and opera.
Yeah, I think there's a story. There's always a story in music, and it's expressed through my music. I'm everything I'm made of. So a part of me is made of classical music. I'm grateful for it. I study diction and breathing control and phrasing and why the song means something. And you want to bring that across to your listeners. Gotta serve it to me.
So this track we're hearing is called Coffee, and I should mention it's only marginally about coffee. how do you like your coffee?
This song, you know, I avoided this song so much. It became a favorite. Rex Rideout, my executive producer, he said, Led, I have this song for you. I want you to hear. I want you to at least demo it. And I kept going, I don't want to. It's too sensual. It's too much describing how I like my man. the lyrics were more risque than what you hear now. So I said, well, if I can change the lyrics around, I'll demo it. And we ended up using the demo. So what you hear is the first takes of everything. I love it now. It's my Shug Avery side. That's what I call it.
Gotta serve it to me hot. That's what you sing.
Just like I like my coffee.
Got it. I mean, a lot of the tracks on this record, they are about intimacy. I mean, this really is an intimate record.
Yes, I wanted it to be that way. You know, people know what I look like. They're starting to know that. And they're starting to know my name and what I'm able to sing, but they don't know anything intimately about me. And so here it is.
Were you nervous about showing that side of you?
Of course. I'm always talking about, you know, the grind of making it and spirituality and things like that. So here I am talking about kisses and hugs and things and coffee. So it's very different. But what's doing music without risk? So here I am.
I'm speaking with R&B soul singer Ledisi about her new record. It's called Pieces of Me. Ledisi, you have a pretty awesome, and I should say powerful fan in the First Lady, Michelle Obama.
Yes.
You have actually met her, right?
Yes, I've met her and spoke, and she's invited me twice to the White House. I performed at the Motown Tribute with wonderful other artists like Seal and John Legend and Stevie Wonder. It was amazing. And then I was invited in the same month by the First Lady to come back and do a mentoring program for women. And she spoke about three women in her speech, and I was one of them, about their journey of never giving up. And I'm sitting in the chair melting, thinking, okay, just smile because you don't have any makeup and everyone's going to look at you. Don't cry. So it was amazing to have someone that powerful to me, who I look up to, look up to me. So it's a mirror. And, you know, after that, I left feeling like I can do anything. So, yeah, that contributed to my confidence that you hear and feel right now. Stuck in the middle, I can see where I've been. My eyes are open and I know where I'm going. So much is in the way. There are people around being negative and they always got something to say. They say you'll never be what you want to be. I love the energy in this song. It's such a great song. This one is called Shut Up. And one of the things that you've said about this record that I've read is that, you know, you're more confident in your music now and in yourself. And I think I hear it in this song. Yes, most definitely. Shut Up was just my, you know, someone cut me off on the freeway in L.A. In Mike City, he produced the track with me, and he gave me the track a long time ago, and I hadn't recorded to it, and that song just came to mind. And I was thinking of all the people that told me, you'll never get far, you're never going to be anything. And I thought about it, and I said, gosh, I wish I could have told them, shut up, because that can defer a dream.
So now that this record is getting a lot of attention, and you're getting a lot more attention than you have in the past, does it feel strange, or do you sort of feel like, you know, I've worked so hard over the last decade, and now I deserve this?
I do feel like I was discussing with my mom about it, and we both started crying. She's like, it's about time, you know, as a mother would say. And me, I'm thinking, wow, now I have even more work to do because the expectations are so high. And they're not saying Ledisi anymore. They're saying Ledisi everywhere I go. So, yeah, it's a bit overwhelming. I'm used to being the nobody. So finally I'm somebody. Well, I always thought I was, but to the rest of the world. And that's a big, big, gosh, it feels good. It feels good.
That's singer-songwriter Ledisi. Her new album is called Pieces of Me, and she joined me from our studios at NPR West in Southern California. Ledisi, thank you so much, and good luck with
the record. Thank you for having me. Thank you. I got a new walk and a new point of view, a new purpose for everything I do. I got a new rule, only real folks around. If you were wondering, I'm about to tell you now. See, it's the same pretty face, but a brand new smile.
Thank thanks for listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Kenya Young, Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, Kevin Lasky, and Megan Kane. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. Remember, you can always catch the entire program on your local public radio station, in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. We're back with a brand new podcast next weekend. Talk to you later. I could stay.